From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Indeed, today is it's a historic moment for all of us to finally vote for our country.
Today, a conversation with the women of East Timor. Also, as the Congressional Black Caucus holds hearings on police brutality in Los Angeles, the FBI probes the killing of an unarmed grandfather who was sleeping with his wife when the police crashed in. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Three UN staff were reported killed yesterday in an East Timor town under siege by militiamen opposed to independence for the territory. UN staff told Australian Broadcasting Corporation Radio that more than 150 UN staff were under siege in the town of Gleno after 40 militiamen sealed the town with roadblocks. Meanwhile, dozens of black-shirted members of the pro-Indonesian Aitarak militia, Aitarak means thorn, were on the streets of the capital, Dili, and a handful were at the airport checking some East Timorese identities. A senior militia leader said they were there to prevent leaders of both sides from leaving. Two trucks filled with militia members, some carrying machetes and all dressed in black T-shirts with the Indonesian flag, drove around Dili. Yesterday, huge numbers of East Timorese turned out in largely peaceful independence ballot despite threats of violence. The United Nations has estimated that more than 90% of the registered voters turned out. European Union diplomats are expected to propose easing sanctions against Kosovo and Montenegro, formalizing a decision taken by EU foreign ministers in July. But Kosovo and Montenegro will not be freed from the current oil embargo and flight ban until the European Commission has come up with a separate proposal to put European Union governments' wishes into effect, a process fraught with difficulties. The sanctions were imposed on Yugoslavia last year by the 15-nation EU, as well as several other countries, in a bid to punish Belgrade for alleged Serb ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, the province now patrolled by NATO-led forces. China has successfully test-fired a ground-to-air anti-aircraft missile on a high plateau, this according to the Liberation Army Daily today. It was the first time China tested the mid-range missile on a plateau, the newspaper said, without specifying where the test was conducted or identifying the missile. The test was in line with the policy of the Air Force to, quote, solidify combat readiness, the newspaper said, in apparent reference to Taiwan. Beijing and Taipei have been locked in a war of words and military posturing following Taiwan President Lee Teng-hui's declaration last month that ties should be on a special state-to-state basis. China, which is threatened to invade if Taiwan declares independence, saw Lee's move as a lurch towards statehood. Beijing regards Taiwan as a renegade province that must be reunified with the motherland. Jordanian authorities have issued arrest warrants for four leaders of the militant Palestinian group Hamas after closing down the group's offices in Amman. This according to sources close to the group. They said none of the leaders were among around a dozen activists arrested yesterday as security forces cracked down on the group, searching its offices and sealing them with red wax. The Jordanian authorities have said the offices were closed after they were found to be used for political activities while they were licensed for commercial use only. A senior Hamas official in Palestinian-ruled Gaza Strip said the closure was a gesture to please the United States ahead of a Middle East tour by Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to revive the Israeli-Arab peace process. Jury selection begins in Texas today in the second trial linked to the gruesome dragging death of an African-American man. Suspected white supremacist Lawrence Brewer is charged with murder. If convicted, he could be sentenced to death. Brewer's trial is being held in Bryan, Texas, 150 miles from Jasper, where the killing of James Byrd Jr. took place. About 175 potential jurors are expected to report today. Lawyers say it could take 2 weeks to choose a panel of 12. Testimony is set to begin on September 15th. The Clinton administration's policy on gays in the military is getting some criticism from an unlikely source, Vice President Al Gore. He tells a gay publication he'd implement Don't Ask, Don't Tell with more compassion. Gore's comments come in an interview published in the latest edition of The Advocate. Last year, 1,145 people were discharged from the armed forces for homosexuality. Gore suggests Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't being carried out, as he puts it, in a way that fully reflects the spirit of the policy. A jury has rejected claims that Exxon Corporation owed the state of California $750 million for allegedly underpricing oil pumped from public lands. Superior Court jurors decided yesterday the state received fair royalty payments during the 1980s for oil taken from the 8,000-acre Wilmington field off Long Beach. Jurors also said Exxon did not act in bad faith or manipulate oil prices. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Three United Nations staff were reported killed in an East Timor town briefly besieged by Indonesia-backed militias opposed to independence for the territory. The UN has so far been unable to confirm the deaths, but reported the siege has ended in the town of Gleno and that 150 UN workers have been evacuated from there. This follows yesterday's historic vote on self-determination for East Timor, which many expect will fall on the side of independence for the territory, which has been under brutal occupation by Indonesia for the past 24 years. Hundreds of thousands of Timorese voted in yesterday's referendum, defying a campaign of terror and intimidation by Indonesia-backed militias, which tried to derail the UN-sponsored vote by killing and terrorizing independence backers. Angry members of the militias blocked roads today, stopped those they suspected of voting for independence from taking planes and ferries from East Timor's capital, following a threat by militia commander Yuriko Gutierrez to close all borders after the vote. Well, yesterday in New York, Timorese exiles living in the Americas cast their vote at a UN office. We heard from three of them, Constancio Pinto, Ace Gutierrez, and the Reverend Arlindo Marsal. Today we're going to hear from women of East Timor, women who were at yesterday's vote as well in New York, Timorese exiles. Actually, yesterday was quite remarkable at this little office on 42nd Street in Manhattan. It was a truly bittersweet time because when I was there, there were about a dozen Timorese there, and each one had a story that really tells the whole story of the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. There were two Timorese priests there, and the brother of one of the priests was executed in front of the other. A young man who fled his family with his family into the mountains and, like so many families, lost members of his family as they tried to survive in the mountains for years. He lost his mother and his sister. Protestant minister was there whose father was disappeared. Husband and wife, young woman pregnant with her first son, who survived the Santa Cruz massacre in 1991 that I also witnessed. In fact, she is here today, as well as another woman who is living in Canada now, in exile, Fran Timor, whose brother survived the massacre at Santa Cruz and who has her own story to tell of how she eventually got out of East Timor. We're joined right now by Gabriela Lopez de Cruz Pinto, survivor of the Santa Cruz massacre, Timorese exile, who now lives in New York, and Isabella Gallos, who was on an exchange program that was sponsored by Indonesia. She went to Canada, and it was there that she defected. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Before we go to the both of you, we wanted to go to Dili, East Timor. It's not always predictable when we're going to get a line into Dili, and it looks like we just did. We're going to go to Dili, East Timor for an update on the situation there, and we're joined right now by journalist Alan Nairn in the territory's capital. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Thanks.
Alan, can you tell us what the latest is? We just read on the program that three UN staff were reported killed today in the East Timor town of Gleno when militia members laid siege to the town, and now 150 UN workers have been evacuated from there.
Was that confirmed that they died?
It says reported killed. So,
yeah, because I know there was a report of that, and it wasn't certain whether they actually did die. They kind of barricaded and attacked this UN convoy.
Are you there? Alan, are you there? We lost him. It is very hard, I have to say, to keep lines into East Timor. It's not easy. So we're going to go back to our guests right now in the studio, Isabella Gallos and Gabriela Lopez de Cruz Pinto. Why don't we begin with Bella Gallos, as she is called by her friends. Bella, yesterday we talked with three Timorese men about their experiences in East Timor, their stories telling the story of the occupation. Can you talk about your life in East Timor? When were you born?
I was born, I was only 3 years old when Indonesia invaded my country. So I didn't remember everything that happened in 1975, but I do still remember all of the story that have been passed on to us, the young generation, through our parents, my elders, and I knew the situation back in 75 was horrible, and the situation in 75, repeatable in my time, grew up under this situation, under this occupation. I witnessed much. My generation, we witnessed much the so-called genocide. Physically and culturally, the people of East Timor have gone through this. And I can just imagine, in my time, it's about late 70s and 80s. Imagine the situation in 75. The situation I went through was already terrible, was worse. And basic rights as a human being does not exist. This is a situation, and it must be very hard for my parents, or those who are older enough, to experience what happened really in 1975.
Now, you, like a number of young Timorese, ended up working with the Indonesian military. Can you explain what happened?
Well, the whole situation, I started to work for the Indonesian government, I mean the military in my country, was right after the Dili massacre. Because I was participate in the demonstration, and I'm survivor of the massacre as well. And my brother was arrested right after the demonstration. And, you know, being arrested by the military is not being arrested in Canada or in the United States where you might still survive. In East Timor, it's like a question of whether you will see them again or never see them again. So right after the massacre, you know, the military rounding up more young people who were suspected and were arrested. And so many of the young people were disappeared at the time. And I was terrified that some of my friends who were arrested at the time will speak out more names of who participated in the demonstration. So I did wanted to act like I was not, I didn't participate in the demonstration. So I registered to be members of Indonesian Military Youth Corps. So at that time, early 92, I started to work for Indonesian government until early 1994, I came to Canada.
And what does that mean to say you worked for the Indonesian government?
Well, I collect information about my friends, Timorines, who are, at the time I was at the University of East Timor, UNTIM. My job was to spy them, what they are doing, who participate in the resistance movement, who aren't, and then collect the information about who they are, what they're doing, where they are, and provide this information, giving it to Indonesian military. And
how did you feel doing that?
Well, it was horrible. You're living kind of in a double life. At the same time, I also support a resistance movement on the ground. I supply help by making donation and helping with passing information to other Timorines about what really the resistance movements are doing. And it was very hard living in this kind of a life. But what I did, I also learned by being with Indonesian military, I learned that they're not smart. So I did, I provide them with false information every week. They didn't notice at all that I was giving them false information. You know, Timorines have most of Timorines have the same name and very long. And every week I make up names and make location and make up name giving to the Indonesian military. And those military who are in East Timor, they're very young age. There is no other opportunity to get a job, and the jobs that are available in Indonesia are become a military. So I therefore use that situation, and I also playing with them.
After the massacre, Indonesian soldiers moved into your family's house?
Yeah, we were forced to adopt two Indonesian military. One, his name is Putu Suardana, and the other one is... two of them from Bali, originally from Bali, but they're military.
What do you mean, adopt them?
Well, because of my brother was arrested at the time right after Dili Mask. So basically my family was known as a family pro-independence. So at that time, most of the Timorines were pro-independence family, were forced to adopt military inside the house to make sure that there was no more further organizing. Against Indonesian government or against Indonesian military at the time. So means like there will be curfew. After 7 o'clock, you'd have to stay in your home. You never go anywhere. And if you go anywhere, it would have to be through their knowledge, their permission.
And they slept in your house?
They slept there. They come 24 hours anytime they want.
So you can't have conversations?
No. When they're around, you have to speak Indonesian language. You cannot speak your language, and you have to act like you just not try to get, they suspect if you're doing anything wrong.
What happened to your brother as a result of the massacre and after he was arrested by the Indonesian military?
Well, my oldest brother have lost all of his fingernails. Body was burned with cigarettes.
They pulled his fingernails out?
Yes. One question, one fingernails. One question, one fingernails. And... he was arrested, put in prison for 6 months. That was hard. And when my mother and I, we went to the first time when they arrested him, we're not allowed to see him over a week. And my mother and I, we went to Bishop Bello for his help. And he was the one that took us. We went from jail to jail. And finally we saw him again in the police station. By the time when we got there, it was already too late because all his face was cut off.
Cut
up, and his fingernails pulled out. Was terribly beaten.
Mm. We are going to break for stations to identify themselves, and we're going to come back to you, Isabella Gallos, as well as Gabriela Lopez de Cruz Pinto, to tell her story and to talk about the future, not only for East Timor, but specifically for women in East Timor. We also hope to make contact again with Dili East Timor and get the latest update from there. After that, we'll be speaking with two Congress members from Los Angeles, as well as anti-police brutality activist on this day following yesterday's police brutality hearing by the Congressional Black Caucus. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our conversation with two women from East Timor. But before we do that, we're going to Dili, East Timor right now. Journalist Alan Nairn is on the line with us. And I should say, as we also just briefly talked to him at the top of the show, that unlike in my situation, Alan was able to defy the blacklist and get into Indonesia, where he's been for the last 4 months, and then has recently made it into East Timor. Alan and I saw on Santa Cruz massacre in Dili, where more than 250 Timorese were killed after we were beaten by the Indonesian military. They fractured Alan's skull, and after reporting the massacre to the outside world, we were banned by the Indonesian military, though that was in 1991. The army blacklist remains, and Alan somehow got in. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Thanks.
Alan, can you tell us the latest from East Timor?
Well, right now, tonight in Dili, people are very frightened. The militias have been out on the streets. Many people are afraid to go out. Today at the airport, the Itarik militia was stopping Timorese from leaving Timor. They were actually snatching the tickets away from them. That UN convoy from Gleno was attacked. There were some Australian observers who were in the Swai district. It's not clear what happened, but they had some trouble with the militias, and they're now being, they say, escorted back to Dili by the police. Also, this morning, I had a chance to talk very briefly to the U.S. Ambassador Stapleton Roy as he was about to leap into a jeep. And I asked him about the Clinton letter, the famous Clinton letter that supposedly admonished Indonesia, the Indonesian government, over the militias. And I asked, did Clinton threaten to cut off U.S. military support if the militias weren't stopped? And Roy responded by saying the letter contained no threats. So then I asked, well, did it at least address the issue of the U.S. arms and ammunition shipments? And he said, I can't recall specifically, but it was not a threatening letter. Roy was clearly very pleased with this letter, and Roy is one of those within the U.S. government who was a staunch apologist for Suharto and is a hardcore backer of the Indonesian military. So apparently there wasn't anything in that letter which was very upsetting to Ambassador Roy.
We should explain this letter. We read about it in the New York Times on Saturday. No one's actually seen the letter, so we've only seen the spin of the newspapers. How does something like that work? And in the New York Times, the article said that Clinton was very firm in saying that international aid would be cut off, World Bank, IMF loans, if the Indonesian military did not stop the violence in Timor.
Yeah, that was the clear implication of the letter. I don't believe the letter really said that. It's inconceivable that Clinton would actually cut off the international financial institution money that flows into Indonesia, because that's a key part of the U.S. economic policy, to shore up Wall Street by keeping the Indonesian currency afloat to some extent and also backing the U.S. multinationals. And I also don't believe that Clinton would threaten an actual cutoff. I think Roy was probably right in saying there were no threats. But it fit the administration's purposes to put that spin on it to the Times, because Clinton was under a lot of pressure from Congress, from groups like the East Timor Action Network, who were pushing very hard to get Clinton to make some statement. They've been pushing for the past 2 months. Finally, on election eve in Timor, Clinton comes out with a statement. They spin it to the paper saying, oh, it was very tough, very strong. Yet we see clearly it has no effect, because you know, Wiranto knows how to read, General Wiranto, the commander of the Indonesian military. He knows how to see whether something is concretely threatening his military backing from the U.S. And if Roy is to be believed, and I think he is in this case, that wasn't, that threat was not held up. Clinton just wants to make angry constituents back in the States think that he was taking tough action.
Well, Alan, I want to thank you very much for being with us, giving us that update, and telling us about the meeting with, or your brief encounter with, the U.S. Ambassador to Indonesia, Stapleton Roy. Alan Aaron speaking to us from Dili, East Timor, where he has gotten in spite of the army ban against him. Well, we're going to turn back now to our discussion of East Timor with two women Timorese exiles who voted in New York, one who lives in Canada, one who lives here in New York. We were speaking with Bella Gayos, who was an exchange program as an Indonesian student. That's how the Indonesian military saw it, even though she was Timorese, in Canada. Can you tell us that last part, Bella, how you ended up in Canada?
With the activities that I have shown to Indonesian government, I mean, the loyalty that I was acting on for over 2 years and a half in East Timor, they see me as another source that could help them in making propaganda on their behalf, in favor of Indonesia. And they always do that. They use Timorines to do things for them, and to, you know, and they pretend they don't do anything, but Timorese do it genuinely and try to help them. So they sent me to Canada, but before then I went through a lot of training and interrogation to make sure that I will do a good job. So I went through a lot of diplomatic training inside Indonesia, in Jakarta, for a month, and I went through over 2 weeks of interrogation myself and my parents to make sure that everything will be all just in their control. And then finally they decided that I'll be doing a good job, so they sent me to Canada. But then when I was in Jakarta, I learned the pressure and the things that they want me to do was, I found it was too much. And inside me, I knew that I couldn't do it, and I will not do it. So when I got to Canada, I was learning so quickly about the situation in Canada, and I defected with the help of my uncle, Constancy Pinto, who are in New York.
Now, you had put his phone number into your waistband of a new pair of pants?
Yes, because of the security reason, all of my clothes at the time brought from East Timor all were new. So I cut one of the pants in the back of the pants, make a little hole, and I put the numbers, his telephone number, inside the hole. So when they went through all of my suitcase, they couldn't find anything. So they let me go after all. And when I got to Canada, I got out and I put the telephone and the address that I was hiding under that hole. And I write him a letter right away, and I send it express with the help of a Canadian woman in Canada whom I don't know anymore. And 3 days later, I got the telephone call from Constancio. And that was the first time we planned and how am I going to defect it. And I did. We did a good job.
And yesterday you voted for the first time in the 24-year Indonesian occupation of East Timor here in New York, where exiles voted. Gabriela Lopez de Cruz Pinto, you grew up in East Timor. Actually, you married Constancio Pinto, who is one of the leaders of the underground. And at the time of the massacre, you were pregnant but went to the cemetery anyway, a time when Timorese were protesting yet another killing of an Timorese by the Indonesian military.
Yes, I did. I was pregnant 7.5 months at the time, but I didn't know that the Indonesian military was going to kill people like that.
So you went to the cemetery?
Yes, I did. At the Motayel Church, we followed a massacre. We followed the demonstration, and then in front of governor's office, mm-hmm. I saw they start beating each other there. So I took a taxi from there with two other friends, and we went to cemetery. And then when we arrived there, the demonstration not arrived yet. So I went inside the cemetery and with Sebastian's relatives.
That Sebastian is the young man who was killed.
Yes. And after we laid the flowers on the grave, when I look back, the demonstrators already arrived, but the military already there before the demonstration. So when we get out from there, there's no way we can escape. So we just stand in front of a door, and then when the demonstration arrived, I saw the military also arrive, and when they arrived, they start shooting, and there's no one in shooting. And when they start shooting, I try to escape, and I lost all my shoes. And I fell down because so many people, they pushed me, and I fell down. I lay down on the ground until the shooting stopped. And I get up, I run into the cemetery, and then I jump over 1 meter wall. And then with all blood on my dress, and I use a path walk to get to home because there's military everywhere. Mm-hmm. And when I arrive at the Kintal boat, it's close to the cemetery. I have a friend live there, and she borrowed me her dress because she also pregnant at the time. So she borrowed me a dress, and I changed my dress, but I didn't left my dress there. I didn't leave my dress there. I take it home.
So there wouldn't be evidence in her house of a bloody dress?
No.
So that there would be evidence, yeah, that someone had been at the massacre site,
yes,
in that house. Well, at the same time that happened with you, Constancio Pinto was underground. There was a nationwide manhunt for him from the Indonesian military. He escaped from the country, and then you were held there, even after your son Tilson was born, for several years, despite efforts by the Red Cross and other international bodies to get you out of the country. What did the Indonesian military do during that period?
During that period, they interrogated me, and they followed me everywhere, even to church, even to visit friends, and they followed me everywhere. They threatened me, and they asked me, they said, why don't you get married? Constancia already died. And they told me, they said, we are handsome, we are pretty, white, and Constance is black, has a flat nose. Why don't you marry us? And I told them, I said, I'm a Catholic and I can't do that. If I do that, my parents will kill me. I'm married at the church, so there's no way I can do that.
Now, this is a standard problem in East Timor for the women of Timor, is many were kept by Indonesian soldiers and high-level officials at their houses.
Yes.
And had their children.
Yeah.
We're talking to Gabriela Lopez de Cruz Pinto, as well as Isabella Gallos. We only have a few minutes, and I wanted to ask about the future for women in East Timor, because it seems that you face a double oppression. One is the Indonesian military, which has been horrendous with the killing of a third of the population. And the other is what happens in your own culture, where women stand. Now, if people follow the Timorese situation, you know there are many male leaders, Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, José Ramos Horta, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Bishop Bello, also Peace Prize winner. We're not hearing from women in leadership. Bella Gallos, why not?
Well, you know, it hasn't been easy being a woman living in East Timor. situation getting worse right after the invasion. I don't say that before then everything was all right. No, it's even getting worse and worse right after the invasion and occupation of East Timor. Our society is male-dominated, and we have a very strong Catholic, very conservative Catholic nation. And we have specific rules that consider as a culture, which are putting women down most of the time. And I see that our future to rebuild a democratic society, independent country, all of this will achieve if, you know, the other half of the population also have the same position in the society, play roles in the society as well. So there's going to be a lot of work need to be done on this matter. But we're determined to do so, and we're very optimistic about it. Particularly the young one, the young generation, we're in a situation where people are very flexible in talking about the situation of women, issues that considered to be taboo, had never been discussed for so many years. Now people talk about it, and I do hope that will be more progress taking place on this matter.
Are there women's groups in East Timor that are functioning, and what are the issues that you focus on?
There are a group of women that exist right after, more active right after Suharto's overthrown last year. They call FOCUPERS, Forum Communication for East Timorese Women. And then they have a good relationship with Indonesian women's group, Solidaritas Perempuan, Cutnya Din. All of these groups, Indonesian women's group in Indonesia, they have been working side by side in helping Timorese women and go through the situation where under Indonesian military occupation and under our male domination, all of that has been a very a good program taking place in East Timor right now in terms of women's for the last few months, they have shown that they have a program and they determined to change the society's ideas of how they look at women.
Domestic violence, a major issue, Gabriela, in East Timor, men beating their wives?
Yeah, because I saw men beating their wives like an animal. They don't care where in the place where they beat, even if it's outside the house. They beaten them up until all their body was swelling. And then sometimes they don't talk to the woman for a few days, even though it's their fault.
As you have discussions with the male leaders of Timor, are these issues you discuss? You're married to one, Gabriela.
I'm married to one, but so far I haven't discussed these things, and he hasn't beaten me up. So.
Well, it's something that is a very sensitive issue. It's not an easy issue to discuss. We do try to discuss this issue. There's a few conferences took place were only filled up by East Timorese women, but the such issue is still not considered as an important issue. It's considered as a secondary issue. You know, right now everybody's focused on liberation of East Timor. So such issue they always consider as a secondary, and they say, wait until later when East Timor is free, and then let's talk about it. This is like same like other country too. You know, take an example of many other countries. This is what their men tell them. So it's up to East Timorese women how they're gonna take this leadership, and just do it, not waiting for the men.
Well, if you two are any indication, the men have quite a challenge in front of them, and we will continue to follow your situation, the situation of women in East Timor, and I thank you very much for being with us. Our guests, Isabella Gayos, who is a Timorese exile, defected to Canada several years ago here in New York for the historic vote on self-determination that took place yesterday in East Timor, and Gabriela Lopez de Cruz Pinto, who is here in the United States as well. Do you both plan to return ever to live in East Timor?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Well, we look forward to covering you there and talking to you when you return. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at, in a sense, you could say official violence, but closer to home. We're going to be looking at police violence in the United States, specifically Los Angeles. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Federal authorities in California have opened an investigation into the in El Monte Police Department's fatal shooting of a 61-year-old grandfather during a drug raid in Compton. Assistant U.S. Attorney Michael Giannacco has asked the FBI to open a probe to see if Mario Paz's civil rights were violated by El Monte officers who shot off the locks to his home last August 9th, then shot him twice in the back during a raid in the middle of the night when he was asleep in bed with his wife. Meanwhile, Los Angeles area police practices came under scrutiny yesterday at a hearing convened by the Congressional Black Caucus. One of those providing testimony was attorney Carl Douglas, who said no police officers have been prosecuted in L.A. County for killing a civilian in the last 4 years. According to Douglas, who is Johnny Cochran's partner, having the district attorney's office investigate allegations of police misconduct is like having foxes guard the hen house. We're joined right now by two Congress members who were part of the CBC delegation that led or the Congressional Black Congress conference yesterday into the hearing of police brutality. Congressmember Juanita Melendez-McDonald is with us, who represents Watts in Los Angeles, and Maxine Waters, Los Angeles Congressmember as well. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Congressmember Melendez-McDonald? What came of yesterday's hearing? Congressmember McDonald? Congressmember
Waters,
yes. Are you there? Yes, okay, sir. I guess we don't have yes. Congressmember McDonald right now. Congressmember Waters, why don't you tell us?
Well, yesterday the Congressional Black Caucus held a hearing in Los Angeles where we were able to talk with not only the families and representatives of victims who have died at the hands of Los Angeles and Riverside police officers, but we were able to talk with the district attorney, the U.S. attorney, with the Los Angeles police chief and with the head of the sheriff's department, along with some others. And basically, we discovered that the district attorney really has not been involved in any serious pursuit of police officers who have killed citizens, that they have not done very many prosecutions, and that they rely on the police department itself to do the investigations. The district attorney was able to talk about one instance where he had done a prosecution, but he had there had been a hung jury, and then when they went back to trial, he lost. But it was very, very revealing after close questioning of him to discover that, again, he does not do his own investigations, that he relies on the investigations of the police department itself. And so it was suggested that perhaps there should be independent counsel here. As a matter of fact, the more we talked about it, the more everyone agreed that there needs to be an outside party, such as an independent counsel, do an investigation in these police matters.
We're also joined by Congressmember Melendez-McDonald. Your observations yesterday as you held this hearing and what you hope to, where you hope to go from here on the issue of police brutality in Los Angeles and overall California.
Thank you so much for having me on. We heard from the victims, families, advocates of police misconduct. We heard from various law enforcement agencies how they conduct reported cases of police misconduct and how they handle this or the lack thereof. The connect and disconnect of these agencies and the district attorney's role in all of this. We heard how some of the cases bear heavily on the public funds, litigation that is, associated with these cases from the local elected officials. Some of the information was quite troubling. Now, when the U.S. attorney came in, there was some resolve given the fact that one of the victims' families had mentioned that the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Attorney's Office refused to protect those who were willing to come forth and break this code of silence that we all recognize as somewhat part of the barrier for getting down to the crux of these cases. The U.S. attorney was able to tell us that he has now begun to investigate this notion that they refused to protect those folks and was willing to allow the people to come forth to break this code of silence and testify on behalf of some of the shootings, unjustified shootings that are going on. I feel that a lot was done in this hearing on yesterday because we were able to probe a little to see if cases are closed and yet victims seem to feel that they did not get the redress that they wanted, where does it go from here? And if, in fact, it doesn't get to where we thought it should go, why not? And so the district attorney role was one that we did find was of a concern as to why cases are closed oftentimes when there's not been a remedy that has been set, you know, that is satisfying to the victims' families, and where do they go from there? So there was a lot that was told and a lot of answers or solutions, I should say, that came from this.
Congressmembers Melinda McDonald and Waters were also joined by Michael Zinzin, who is a police brutality victim himself, got a big settlement from Los Angeles County, and heads up a group called Coalition Against Police Abuse and is a member of the Black Radical Congress. Now, Michael Zinzin, you weren't invited yesterday to the CBC hearing. What are your observations about what the problem is and what you think the solution needs to be? Are you encouraged by what you've heard happen yesterday?
Well, I think, first of all, thank you for inviting me on your program. I think that what we're talking about is old news. The DA stopped investigating cases right after the O.J. Simpson attempt at prosecution. They claimed that they used all their money up, and so since then they have allowed the police to police themselves once again. Even when the DA's office was investigating incidents of police abuse from 84 to 94, they only made 12 attempts at prosecuting officers. So I think what we have is a crisis, a continued crisis, they are relying on the police to police themselves. We did not participate. We were not invited. However, we would not have just stood up there and once again participated in what we call a cattle call, where you call a bunch of people, they jam themselves in there, they got a few minutes to say something, and not give an opportunity for a serious analysis of this problem. We cannot rely on our Congress people to be the leadership in this. The community must be the leadership, and they simply act as functionaries. Anytime that we rely on them solely to resolve our problems, then what we do is we have it shifted from one a day to another, and it takes years, just like the question of the crack cocaine in the CIA. When we had the hearings here, and both congresspersons participated, and very little came out of that because it was stymied, covered up, even though the truth was there. I think that some of the serious crisis is still the code of silence. I think another key thing is the margin of error that policemen are allowed to do their work in. The margin of error allows them to shoot and kill and get away with by saying their foot slipped, they thought the person had a gun, they felt their lives were in danger. That margin of error has never been attacked. It has never been criticized. It has never been no policies have been developed for that margin of error. Everything that's been developed has been outside of that margin of so-called error that a policeman is allowed to function under. And that's why we still continue to have police abuse, and no policemen are in jail or charged with murder. And that's what one of the problems is. And until they address that, we're going to continue to see people gunned down by the police and within that margin of error give every excuse under the sun. We think that the DA's office should be stripped of all of its responsibility, and the police should be stripped of its responsibility for investigating police crimes.
Congressmember Maxine Waters?
Yes.
What do you think of that? The idea of, I mean, you did recommend an independent counsel, perhaps, and that would take it out of the district attorney's office, which so closely works with the police. But do you think this is a realistic possibility?
Well, let me just tell you this. I don't work based on whether or not I think someone else is necessarily going to agree. I don't take a backseat to anybody on the work on police brutality. I've led the fight against Daryl Gates for many years, and I marched and rallied with my women's group and demonstrated in front of Parker Center at the death of Eula Love and worked on it for many years and basically confronted Daryl Gates as one person who was willing to take on the police chief and continue to do that. I deal with police brutality issues. I deal with the issues of crime in the intelligence community. And sometimes I have to work on these issues for many years. I worked to help bring down apartheid in South Africa for 9 years in the California legislature before we were able to pass it. So I may have to work on this for the rest of my career. I don't know. All things are possible, and I work toward what I believe is right, and I'll continue to do that.
Well, as we said at the beginning of this segment, the FBI says it's now investigating how the El Monte police shot an unarmed man in the back as he slept in his own home. Mario Paz's family says it's filing a lawsuit against the department after police shot their way into his house and killed him in bed. The police say an officer feared that Paz was armed or was reaching for a weapon, which is a characterization disputed by the family. El Monte police have been looking for an alleged drug dealer who had used Paz's address. Police have since said they had no information to tie Paz or his family to drug trafficking and still don't have any information or evidence of wrongdoing. Brian Dunn is also with us. He is an L.A. attorney representing the family of Mario Paz from the firm Cochran, Cherry, Given, Smith and Ferrer. He's handling it along with Johnny Cochran. Brian Dunn, can you briefly summarize this story that has sparked a lot of outcry since August 9th when it happened in Los Angeles?
Sure, and thank you. Essentially, you discussed the major points. This was a raid that took place while the family was sleeping. At approximately 11 o'clock p.m., they were awakened to the sounds of shotguns literally blasting through the metal security doors in the front and the back of the home, as well as shotguns blasting through the windows of one of the bedrooms of the home. Not long after the officers gained entry, they quickly made their way back to the bedroom where Mario Paz and his wife slept. And within seconds after entering the bedroom, they opened fire on Mario Paz and shooting him twice in the back in the presence of his wife. At the time the shots were fired, they were in their underwear. The wife was screaming, pleading with them not to shoot. It's also undisputed that Mario was unarmed, and he was shot twice in the back. I have seen the photos of the body. He was shot squarely in the back two times.
What do you think can stop further killings like these? What do you think would be the most effective answer?
Well, I think that this is and problem it doesn't lend to a simple answer. I've heard some of the comments that have been made by some of the individuals associated with the Congressional Black Caucus, and I applaud those the work in that regard. I think from what I've seen, the problem is more related to a culture among certain, and I do mean certain groups of law enforcement personnel, and it's a testosterone-driven culture, and it's a culture that doesn't have a lot of respect for the people that are in the communities where these police practices occur. All of the officers that were involved in the August 9th raid got on their cars and drove in freeways to cities that were far away from where this incident occurred, and those are the cities that they live in. And
has any police officer been indicted for the Paz killing?
Oh, no. I just recently, actually, yesterday, heard that that the Department of Justice was even going to open an investigation.
And this was a SWAT team set up under Daryl Gates' time in the late 60s?
Actually, the information that I have to date is that it was a SWAT team that was with the El Monte Police Department. And as far as I know, that Daryl Gates was responsible for bringing the SWAT mentality to Southern California. I don't know if he specifically trained any of the officers that were involved in this raid.
Congressmember Juanita Melender McDonald, are you calling for a federal investigation into the Paz killing?
At this time, I have not been associated and deeply involved in that case. But let me just say, in getting back to the gentleman who spoke from the coalition, these are old stories. We have heard them way, way back, even before the Eula Love stories. And he is absolutely correct that the community must be involved. But we have to continue, while they are old stories, while it seems that there is no remedies coming out of these, we have to keep fighting. The recommendations that came from the hearing yesterday, we will continue to monitor those. But the gentleman who just spoke brought up an important issue. When I ask about a different type of training and a cultural diversity training, both of the representatives of the police and sheriff agencies stated that they were involved in, or they were looking into that type of training. When I ask about the community policing, they mentioned that Juan mentioned that he was, they were deeply involved with that. The other mentioned that too, but my definition of community policing was that the police get out of the cars, engage in the communities of people of color, and not pass by strolling in their cars, looking out as if they are suspicious or suspect something. And when it was clear that a lot of the police officers, as the gentleman said, get in their cars and go away from this community. Live
we just have 10
out.
Seconds.
I think that we certainly should have more police officers who live in our community helping to secure the community.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much all for being with us. That wraps up the discussion. I want to thank Congressmembers Juanita Melender McDonald and Maxine Waters joining us, Congressmembers from California, Michael Zinzin, Coalition Against Police Abuse, and Attorney Brian Dunn representing the Paz family. Maria Cadillac and David Love produced the show. Bernard White engineered. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.